Premier Christian Newscast.
Ecumenism. Even the word itself is probably putting some of you off right now. A tiresome bit of churchy jargon that has no relevance for your church or spiritual life, right? But working for unity across churches and denominations is for some a genuine passion, an urgent priority, even a lifetime's ministry. Earlier this year, a group of Catholic and Anglican bishops spent several days in discussions, joint services, pilgrimages, and worship together. As these kind of ecumenical events always do, it ended with lots of warm words, a fairly vague joint communique, and promises to come back and do it all again in a few years' time. But did it actually change anything on the ground? Are denominations as separate as Catholicism and Anglicanism actually serious about trying to reunite? Why do people bother with ecumenism? Is the task fundamentally about reconciling our different theologies or merging our separate institutions? Should it be taken more seriously by ordinary churchgoers and ministers? Or is it just about cups of tea and endless talking shops? I'm Tim White, and for this week's Premier Christian Newscast, we're exploring why people do work for church unity, whether they're making any progress, and what on earth the rest of us should think about all their efforts. We'll be joined by theologians, church leaders, and ecumenical activists to talk through what's the point in ecumenism, and should we all be getting more involved? Well, hello, and thanks so much for joining us, everyone. Before we kick off the conversation, it would be great if you could each kind of briefly introduce yourselves, who you are, what you do, and how in particular you're involved in the ecumenism world. Jan, why don't you go first?
Okay, hello, everyone. My name's Jan Novotnik. I'm a Roman Catholic priest. Currently, I work with the Catholic Bishops of England and Wales as their director of mission, but perhaps in this context, more importantly, I'm also their ecumenical officer. So I represent them ecumenically and spend a lot of time with my brothers and sisters from the other Christian churches, and particularly with churches together in England, working on training for ecumenical officers and the work that the church does to promote Christian unity. So in a nutshell, that's who I am and what I'm doing.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you on the show. Paul, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Paul Murray. I'm a professor of systematic theology at Durham University. I'm a Catholic layman, and my involvement in ecumenism has been through... I was teaching for some years at a Catholic seminary which ran an ecumenical program with the Anglican Training House and Methodist, and that took me into the world of ecumenism in a more formal way than it had been, and as a result, we developed an approach called receptive ecumenism, which was trying to look at how to take the ecumenical challenges forwards at a time when there are some real difficulties with how that had been done for the previous 40 years or so.
Yeah. Fantastic. And last but not least, Christopher.
Hi, I'm Christopher Lando. I'm an Anglican priest and the director of Resource, which is an Anglican renewal charity. But I guess I'm particularly here because my doctorate in Christian ethics was particularly focused on the ethics of disagreement among Christians and reading the New Testament with a view to seeing to what extent that call to loving unity actually is at the heart of the Christian faith, and therefore why do we often struggle to put that into practice so much?
Brilliant. Well, I'm really pleased to have all three of you on the show. Really looking forward to hearing what you've got to say. Before we launch into it, ecumenism is one of those things that some Christians will have never thought about once in their entire lives. Could someone give me a kind of potted definition in a sentence or two? What do we mean when we talk about ecumenism? Anyone want to jump at that one?
Well, I think you'd be very good at that, Paul. You'd give a great definition.
Well, I guess there are different definitions. It's recognizing that the one Church of Christ is in institutional terms is divided, and that the One Church of Christ divided to the point of not being able to fully recognize ministry across all traditions, not being able to feel able to share in full communion across all traditions, because some churches judge that certain perspectives and doctrinal positions are incompatible. So that this came to the modern ecumenical movement, really came to light through the Protestant missionary movement in the 19th century. And people became aware of a sense of lived contradiction between the preaching of the gospel of reconciliation on the one hand, and the fact that on the ground, different Christian churches and traditions were competing over turf and souls, soul and soil. So there was a kind of lived contradiction going on there, and that the work of evangelization was majorly hindered. So that gave rise to the 1910 Edinburgh Mission, World Missionary Conference. And that's it wasn't the beginnings of things in any strict sense, but it was a major, major nodal event. And from that, some of the major streams, plural, of modern ecumenism flowed out of that. And there are a number of different streams. It's not just one thing, Christian ecumenism. It's actually many different things. Yeah.
And if I'm right, that kind of modern ecumenical movement that was kind of coming into focus in the early 20th century, that later grew into things like the World Council of Churches or the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity and other kind of institutional elements of ecumenism. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's important to recognise that there are multiple streams that fed into the World Council of Churches. There's the Life and Works movement, which is very much about how can Christian traditions across their differences do things together, pray together, worship, go on mission together, witness together. And that's really important, but it doesn't in itself overcome the structural and at times sacramental divisions between traditions. So the complementary to that was the Faith and Order movement, which in some respects is more theologically driven rather than practically driven, and is concerned to look at what are regarded as some of the causes of structural sacramental division, and look at whether actually they need to be separating reasons, or whether they can be overcome, ameliorated in any way, whether there's new understandings that help us forward. So that's it's important to look at that kind of a multi-stranded cord, really.
Yeah. I'm going to want to come back to those two kind of aspects of the kind of theology and the practical on the ground a bit later. But the kind of peg, the reason we're talking about this now is because in a few months ago, Roman Catholic and Anglican bishops were part of a big kind of jamboree, if I can use that casual language, over many days. Jan, I imagine you were quite deeply involved in that. Do you want to kind of explain what was going on there, what it was like to be a part of?
Yeah, well, I was deeply involved. I was on the planning team for it. And basically, in a nutshell, what happens is every 2 years, the Roman Catholic and Anglican bishops try to meet together to pray together, to discuss certain current issues of concern or interest, joys and challenges really being a Christian in contemporary society. But the focus really, I suppose, is on the fact that we get together to pray. So as you say, we met, I'm trying to remember when it was, end of January, beginning of February, for an overnight, 2 days and an overnight, this time in Norwich. 2 years before, we'd been in Liverpool. Some of the focus this time for the conversations was reflecting on the coronation of King Charles. And of course, we had in the room people who'd been really involved in the coronation of King Charles, the Archbishop of Canterbury and also the Archbishop of York. And they were able to speak from their own particular context. But of course, we also had Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the president of the Roman Catholic Bishops Conference. And, it was the first time in centuries that a Catholic prelate not only was present for the coronation, but also was able to say a prayer alongside other members of Christian denominations, and in fact, people of other faiths. And so it was really good to be able to talk about those kind of things. We didn't just talk about the coronation. We moved into the whole area of synodality, something that's going on in the Catholic Church at the moment. And I don't want to say a compare and contrast with the synodical structures of the Anglican Church, but obviously there was some crossover there, which we talked about. And we also talked about the influence of an English saint, St. John Henry Newman, who started his life as an Anglican and became a Catholic, you know. And it was interesting to hear again once about his history, his life. So there's a lot going on in the formal kind of meetings. But particularly important, I think, was the time of prayer in Norwich Cathedral. We prayed evensong together. The Catholic bishops attended an Anglican Eucharist celebrated by Archbishop Justin Welby. And of course, there was the social times where we ate together, drank wine together, you know, and really walked and talked with each other. It was a fantastic experience, actually.
From your perspective, are these kind of gatherings, are they about kind of building close friendships between leaders of different denominations and about finding common ground? Or is it hope that this will actually be a part of a long process towards some kind of eventual unification, you know, merging, joining together in a more kind of formal sense?
I think, you know, the deep desire, and, you know, Paul was just talking about, you know, the Edinburgh Missionary Conference and the World Council of Churches. I think also we have the, you know, at Vatican II, Catholics committed themselves in their own teaching to say, you know, that we want the church to be one. We believe this is what Christ wants for the church. So I think the ultimate aim is always that we desire Christian unity. The difficulty is we're quite a long way from that. So, you know, gatherings like what happened in Norwich is about friendship. It is about building relationships, the bishops within their own areas. So, you know, the bishops of the Northeast might sit together and the bishops from the Midlands might be together. And yes, they see each other from time to time, but in the context of being together as two colleges of bishops, if you like, they're able to relate with each other, see the common joys and challenges, you know, so that when things are going on, a Christian response can be made, and actually they can do it together because they've already been with each other, they know something of the thinking, they know what the personalities are like. So I think it's both and. I think there is that desire, you know, deep desire for unity, but we realise that there are so many challenges to that. And the basis is, and some people would say, oh, well, you just have cups of tea with each other. But actually, the basis of walking together always is predicated on having a good relationship. And that's what you see the bishops growing into more and more. Well, I do anyway.
Brilliant to say that we're joined by Shamara Fletcher-Hoyt. Thanks, Shamara, for coming on. Would you mind just briefly introducing yourself for people who haven't come across you before? How are you involved in the world of ecumenism?
Yes, that's amazing. Thank you so much for having me. So as I said, I'm Shamara Fletcher-Hoyt, and I'm the Principal Officer for Pentecostal, Charismatic and Multicultural Relations at Churches Together in England. CTE is the national instrument for ecumenism, where we bring over 52 member churches together for the purpose of unity. And I have particular responsibility for the Pentecostals and Charismatics in helping them to engage with other parts of the church.
Fantastic. Well, I'm really pleased you could join us. We've just been talking a little bit about some of the history of the kind of ecumenical movement, and then Jan has been updating us on the recent gatherings of Anglican and Roman Catholic bishops. Christopher, I wanted to come to you next, actually. You know, Paul kind of explained how ecumenism grew out of kind of mission movement and this sense of dissonance as people were finding between what the gospel says and how they were lived out on the ground. In your experience, are lots of Christians genuinely interested in this idea of kind of unification, or is it just the preserve of a few weirdos like ourselves who actually care about this kind of thing?
I think what's interesting is how, particularly when Christians find a common purpose, actually you then see ecumenism in action, but not necessarily with an ecumenical badge, if you like. So I think it's fascinating over the last few decades how initiatives like the street pastors or the advent of food banks would be two huge examples where actually in most towns up and down the country, you've got very often groups of Christians from across a wide diversity of churches working together. And often I think there is an energy and a sense of possibility in that, whereas sometimes I think if we're honest, those ecumenical services for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity can sometimes feel a bit more of a duty than a joy. There can be a sense of finding the lowest common denominator that doesn't offend anyone rather than actually embracing the richness of different traditions. But I think for me, the really interesting question is the ethical question at the heart of all of this. And actually, have Christians often, even if bishops are quite good at meeting together, Christians in the public square often become rather intensely relaxed about a level of conflict that we just get used to living with. And we're so used to it on social media in every sphere of our lives. And it's almost as if we therefore are uncritical of that happening within the life of the church. And for me, it was always John 13:35 that was the kind of foundation for the work I did. By this, you'll know that they are my disciples. See how they love one another. And that sense that, you know, on the night before he dies, Jesus affirms to the disciples, it's not just how you will serve the poor that those outside the church will recognise that you're my disciples, but actually the quality of those relationships within the church. And I think we have a very ambiguous legacy in terms of how well we've managed to guard and cherish those relationships.
Hmm. Shamar, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. When you meet kind of ordinary Christians and talk about what you do at Christians Together, do they kind of scratch their heads or do they actually get it that actually, yeah, this is important, urgent work trying to build unity across traditions?
Yeah, I think it's important what you just said about important, urgent work. I think people see it as important, but not always urgent. I think that people are always worrying about their own denominations. What are they doing to build their own members? And ecumenism can sometimes be seen as the thing that you do if you have more time. Something that I've seen, though, an interesting find is after the pandemic, where resources were tight, where people were struggling, they saw how ecumenism could be a tool to work together, to share resources. Instead of having five churches doing five food banks, what does it look like for those five churches to come together and deliver one service and then share resources in other spaces? So I think it's important. I think the question of urgency is one to explore, and even to help people to see ecumenism beyond their own self-interest. We are human. That self-interest is something that we'll always have to grapple with. So a lot of ordinary Christians do ecumenism if it works for me, if there is an end product. And I think that that's a problem of capitalism. Sorry to bring that into it. You know, if there's a return on investment, I'll get involved. But what does it mean to just be unified? Because it's one of the commands of the gospel.
Paul, you mentioned earlier about the kind of two streams. You have kind of institutional talks at top level, faith and order commissions trying to rationalize if we can find a way to share a common view. You know, famously, there was a shared position on justification, I think, that the Lutherans and the Roman Catholic churches managed to find as a way of trying to heal some of the divide of the Reformation. But there's also this kind of grassroots thing that Shamara is talking about, where people on, you know, in a town say, why are we in five empty buildings? We could all combine together. Do you think, where are we at right now? Which of those two streams do you think is kind of dominant or stronger or more kind of energetic at present?
Yeah. So I'm very much a both and kind of person. You know, I kind of want to see the value in these multiple strategies and see them as complementary rather than saying that only one or the other. But something that Shamar was saying, I think, is really important about the recognition that ecumenical partnership cannot just be yet another kind of demand on the long list of good things we're meant to do. And it never quite gets into focus because there's lots of other more pressing things. But when we, if we kind of spin the telescope around a bit and think of it differently and ask ourselves, in what sense is ecumenical engagement an opportunity for our enrichment rather than just a kind of headache, yet another headache that we give ourselves to try and satisfy? And one of the ways in which that sense of it being a place of opportunity and possibility, as Shamara is saying, can be in very practical ways, very practical initiatives. So the question I'm interested in asking is, how can something of that cross-fertilization for greater flourishing of each of the traditions, even when we are short of full communion, a greater flourishing of our respective traditions, how can something of that take effect also in the more formal theological ecumenical engagements and not just the practical mission-based discipleship or social witness areas? And I think there is real fruitfulness there, and actually it doesn't need to just happen at the kind of level of international dialogues. Let me give you a very down-to-earth prosaic example of this. Most of our church traditions have some form of church meetings, okay? And in congregational churches and Pentecostal churches, they are really central to how the life of the church and decision making happens. You know, but even in a context like the Catholic Church, we have church-based, parish-based meetings. We've got parish councils, and you know, they're not always the most functional and effective meetings in the life of the church, it has to be said. You know, and I kind of speak with Anglican friends and they say, and I say, it's really great that you've got these formal structures. And they say, those formal structures can be really irritating, you know? So in the Catholic context, we can kind of scratch our heads and say, so how can we do the parish council thing better? Which is key to this whole move that we're now into of becoming a more synodal church. And what we would typically do is ask someone from the diocese to come from the education or the pastoral formation office to come and tell us, you know, what good practice might be in a parish council. But wouldn't it be really interesting if what we instead did over a period of a couple of months was to have a session where somebody from a local Pentecostal church came and spoke to us about how they run their meetings and how they work in those meetings. Someone from the Friends could come and explore how their business meeting is a prayer meeting. Someone from the Methodist church could come and explore what the whole connectional thing means. And, you know, none of those, it's not going to be like going to M&S and being able to take a suit off the peg and put it straight on, you know, put the Methodist suit on and suddenly it fits straight away in a Catholic context. It's more like music, being inspired by the Methodist performance, by the Anglican performance, by the Presbyterian performance, the Pentecostal performance. That's going to expand the Catholic imagination as to what a good Catholic parish council meeting might be. That is a place of real encounter with each other in the spirit, discerning the way ahead for the church. That's what I would refer to as receptive ecumenism on the ground in practice. But it's also, that's also a move that we can be doing at a more formal theological level. So the most recent round of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, and that's, you know, that's had an important journey over many decades now. It's been one of the leading bilateral dialogues, which has shaped the way in which other dialogues have worked. And in the past, it has had great success at being able to identify that some of the ways in which Catholics and Anglicans historically have believed themselves to have to be divided over points, we've managed to, in previous decades, we've managed to say, well, actually, some of these are based on misunderstandings of each other. We can clear them up. And then others of them, well, we're in a different world and we kind of have more, we have new knowledge about things that have enabled us to understand certain aspects differently. So we've been able to move forwards on some aspects of Eucharistic doctrine because of how we think of making memory. Or it might be that we've said, you know, some differences don't need to divide. Some differences can enrich. And let's get clearer about the fact that we don't always need to be saying exactly the same thing in exactly the same voice. Sometimes it's about choral singing and complementarity. Those strategies have been really powerful, but they can't solve everything. And we're now in a situation where we're faced with some issues that don't lend themselves to being dealt with by those strategies. But that receptive ecumenical strategy that I traced as happening at a local parish level, Archic is now using at a formal theological level and saying, okay, let's, instead of getting dispirited by the things that we don't seem to be able to resolve at this point, let's actually turn differently and ask ourselves where the difficulties are in our own traditions. Difficulties, say, around decision-making, and ask where we might be able to fruitfully learn from something in the other tradition in a way that could actually really serve to change our respective traditions and open further possibilities down the line that we can't currently see, but that in faith we know will unfold if we do today what's possible in our backyard, in the hope that tomorrow the horizon will open greater. Any of us who are runners know that you run at the horizon and it doesn't close down. It just keeps opening up in front of you, okay? How ecumenically can we walk together towards the horizon in ways that change each of our traditions and in ways that open possibilities for tomorrow that today we can't see?
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
I mean, that sounds incredibly inspiring, exciting, enthusing. I guess the cynical-minded listener might say, that's all very well, Paul, but fundamentally, you know, Anglicans and Catholics or Pentecostals and Presbyterians, the reason they are in separate traditions is because they have these fundamental disagreements, to use that language, Christopher, and those are never going to go away, and we could spend hundreds of years trying to receive each other as a gift and all that stuff, but fundamentally we just believe different things about what it is to be a church, and that, so that may be okay. Is that a permissible kind of position to take, Christopher?
Well, I think there's a need for a kind of fierce honesty, I suppose. So, you know, the honest truth is that the official Catholic position, notwithstanding all of the lovely meetings of bishops and the lovely pictures that we've had from the Vatican of bishops being sent off in pairs on mission, and yet still, you know, the papal bull that says that Anglican orders are absolutely null and utterly void is still in place. And so I think for me, there is a question of how far can we run towards Paul's sort of sunlit uplands whilst that remains, you know, a bit of a kind of boulder on the way. And you have to ask yourself the question, you know, is there a way around that? The other thing that really weighs on my mind at the moment is something which is very significant, that the Coptic Orthodox Church should have formally suspended its ecumenical dialogue with the Catholic Church. It's believed over the proposals about blessings of same-sex couples, which, of course, in the Catholic Church, what's proposed is far, far less than what the Anglican Church is currently splitting itself over. And so in all of this, I suppose, for me, there is this profound need to ask those questions about what's going on in our own heart at a personal and communal level, but also try and join the dots meaningfully and be honest about the fact that where there are significant roadblocks, that can't be entirely ignored or simply see the receptive ecumenism process as a kind of way that solves all of the structural problems that exist. And I think how to get that balance right is difficult. But I think sometimes for certain clergy on the ground or at the coalface, for example, they see the bishops having their nice meetings and their photo calls, and they say, well, that's all very well, but actually those same bishops continue to have the rules, which mean that at a local level, actually what we can do together, particularly in shared worship, is considerably restricted. There are ways around it. I've seen, for example, quite moving examples where Catholics and Anglicans might find ways of being at a communion service together, even if the Anglicans, for example, at a Catholic Mass would receive a blessing rather than receiving the sacrament. But I think it's possible to do that actually in a very meaningful and moving way, which is respectful of all that is shared, but without pretending that everything is as yet resolved.
Shamara, I'd love to know your thoughts on this particular question, particularly as someone who's working closely with churches that might have kind of less of the institutional ecumenical structures like Archic and these kind of things.
Father Jan spoke about the power of relationship within ecumenical spaces to offer us understanding. And I'd add to that, we also need humility. I think humility can lead us to a type of denominational kenosis, a willingness to empty yourself of some of your denominational dogmas, denominational cultural assumptions, and enter what we'd say in the Pentecostal tradition, a more kingdom mindset. You know, if I'm able to share a personal story, at the age of 21 as a Pentecostal growing up in Birmingham, I went on an internship and spent 2 years in an Anglo-Catholic church. I've never taken so much communion in my life. I didn't know how I reached to this point, but actually I was then deepened in my own tradition. What that experience taught me is the power of translation. So whilst my Anglo-Catholic brothers and sisters would talk about evangelization, we would call it evangelism. When they'd speak about the spirit, I was like, oh, we say that, we just call it something different. But relationship and that denominational kenosis, my willingness to put down some of my dogmas, allow me not only to strengthen my own faith and tradition, but also to appreciate what is happening in other parts of the kingdom. At CT, we have a lot of bilateral conversations, one of which was between the Pentecostals and the Orthodox, our Orthodox brothers and sisters, and even how they speak about pneumatology. You saw so much synergy in how they speak about the outworkings of the Holy Spirit, but that was only allowed to happen because of relationship and then humility and then a willingness for that kenosis. Empty out some of your dogmas. Once we put that down, it's a beautiful thing that ecumenism can bring us into. That would be my response to that.
And any thoughts on this particular part of the conversation we're having?
Oh gosh, I knew you were going to come to me. I think I think one of the things I want to say is that, you know, in the role I have with the bishops, I'm very much like a church bureaucrat. I mean, loads of my friends say to me, what actually do you do every day? And, you know, I sort of say, well, if you know what the civil service does for the government, which perhaps isn't always the best analogy, that's how we work for the bishops. Now, of course, I'm going to, in some way, defend that it's really good that the bishops are together. And, you know, I've studied lots of the bilateral agreements with the Anglican Church, with the Orthodox Church, with the Methodist Church. You know, formerly I spent a lot of time studying these, and you know, I maintain, like Shamar has just been saying, that at the basis of all that we do is predicated upon relationship ecumenically. But that doesn't take away what Chris was talking about, the deep struggle that actually we are very divergent, sometimes in doctrine, sometimes in the way that we do things. And you know, quite rightly, some friends of mine would say to me, well, you go to General Synod, for example, which is true. I am Catholic Observer. Shamara's there also at General Synod, and we're treated very kindly by the members of the Anglican Communion. We have exalted situation to sit in. If we want to speak, we're always called as ecumenical reps, you know, and it's a pleasant experience. It really is a good experience. But as many of my friends would say, well, why do you bother, actually? Because the Anglican and the Catholic Church are never going to have unity, because let's cut to the chase. Anglicans ordain women. The Catholic Church say that's impossible. How can you have unity? So I think, you know, there is a deep, deep struggle there, you know, and it would be naive just to say it's about relationship. I think relationship's a good starting point. But I think sometimes in our doctrinal discussions, yeah, of course, we all get entrenched in what we actually believe. And I think sometimes, and I've witnessed it when I've been in the room here in England with either Methodists or Anglicans or members of other churches, where we've had really, really good discussions and really said what is very painfully obvious, where we really disagree. And sometimes we have to agree to disagree. And we know that that pain is there. And I think it's just frustration, and it is a struggle which will never go away until, as Shamara says, we try to be a bit more humble, and we really try and listen to what the Holy Spirit is saying to the church. And my final thought on this, you know, I'd say, and here comes the church bureaucrat again, I really do think Pope Francis, you know, has tried to give those of us in the Catholic Church an example of how to do this. And I think, you know, Paul mentioned about the synod and the structures that we're having. One thing that Pope Francis said in preparing for our synodal discussions was, don't just speak to Catholics, speak to others, speak to other Christians, speak to other people who have no faith even. And there were loads of Catholic priest friends of mine who said, I think the Pope is completely cracked. Why would we want to find out what people who aren't Catholics think about the church or what life is about? But actually, when you do that, you may not always agree. Sometimes you don't. You're completely opposed to what someone else is saying. But at least you've heard their view. And at least if you then stop with humility to accept that that view is valid, even if you don't agree with it, it's somebody else's view, then you have a starting point. And I think too much of the time, people accuse us wacky ecumenists of going for the lowest common denominator. And I don't think we always do that, but we can't always be arguing with each other. So I think you have to find the balance where the relationships work. Sorry, I've probably gone on for too long there.
No, it's really interesting. And I guess it leads me to ask, you know, you talked about agreeing to disagree. Maybe that's okay. You know, people often come back to Jesus's words, you know, that his prayer for all his followers to be one, but that oneness, does it have to look like formal, you know, a merging of the Anglicans and Catholics? Or, you know, there's been previous attempts, the Methodists and the Anglicans almost merged in the 70s and 80s before it all fell apart. You know, maybe we need to put that and put one side and say that's clearly never going to happen, but that oneness could be found despite our deep and irreconcilable disagreements.
Well, I think it's one thing to recognize that we don't need to work towards uniformity or strict identity. That's a good thing for us to have come to recognize. But if we then say, and therefore that means that we should just kind of accept the fact that we're in a situation where we cannot recognize each other as fully Christian in some regard, in some respects. Now that is a wound in the one body of Christ when we can't do that. And that is something under which we surely stand judged as wanting. So I think again, it's about discerning, you know, what's about an appropriate forms of diversity that we can hold in communion, and what are regarded as points of difference that breach communion, and do they really need to stand as such? If I could just add a footnote to the relationship thing, I do basically agree that, you know, relating can't solve everything. And particularly if by relating, we basically mean being nice to each other, having tea and crumpets and doing a bit of prayer, you know, that is not going to solve everything. It's a good start, but it's not going to solve everything. However, relating can be more substantive in its implications than that. Because if in relating, what we are doing is allowing ourselves to come to experience the graced presence of Christ in the other, then actually that takes us again to a place where we, you know, we're responsible for how we respond to that presence of Christ in the other, for that truth of Christ in the other. And the thing on ministry, well, that's one of the places where we get some really interesting blurrings, isn't it? Yes, the Catholic Church has not yet formally unpicked that. And I say this as a Catholic layman, I'm freer to say it than perhaps some others, that really unhelpful bit of teaching that we have. We've not yet formally unpicked it. The same church that hasn't formally unpicked it, Pope Paul VI puts his own episcopal ring on the finger of Michael Ramsay when Michael Ramsay visits Rome. On another visit, a crozier is given. I mean, what is being said here? What is being said here about the recognition of the ministerial presence of Christ in the other? Okay, so we've got some theological tidying up to do, which requires us to do that uncomfortable stuff of finding out how to unpick, let's call them knots. We've all got knots in our traditions, you know? All got knots in our traditions that need to be unpicked. And that's just relating isn't going to do it. What relating will do is make us see the urgency of it. Because falling in love impels us to find ways over the obstacles to full communion.
Christopher, go on, yeah.
No, I mean, I'm tempted to say one person's knot is not another person's knot, which, of course, is part of the challenge. I think I was asked to write a blog for the Tablet, the Catholic newspaper, in relation to the beginnings of the synodal process. And partly, I suppose, I was saying, be careful what you wish for in relation to an Anglican synodical model that has become so quasi-parliamentary that the question is how recognisably Christian as a means of decision-making is this? And certainly one of the challenges within the Anglican communion is the splitting and the splitting within the splits. And for me to go back to the Council of Jerusalem, as reported in Acts chapter 15, which includes some element of compromise in terms of how the Gentile believers are to be incorporated into the body, but also ends with that wonderful phrase, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. And for me, that recovery of the place of the Spirit inspiring the relationships within churches and beyond churches. I'm now involved in the charismatic movement. And one of the fascinating high points for me in the kind of recent history of that was a conference in 1971 at Guildford Cathedral, which is the only cathedral in the Church of England dedicated to the Holy Spirit. And this conference brought together Pentecostals, Roman Catholics, Protestant evangelicals, all worshipping together. And I think at that point, the recognition between Protestant evangelicals, some of them Anglican, that they were worshipping the same God as Roman Catholics and that they were experiencing the ministry of the same Spirit was really transformational. And I do think that actually a pneumatological focus can really be releasing and helpful in this. And indeed, I think that that's one of the sometimes hidden aspects of why there have been so many higher level advances between this Pope and Archbishop of Canterbury, because both of them have been very heavily influenced by charismatic renewal. And I think both of them, whatever we think of their approach to politics within and beyond their churches, both of them have that hugely high regard for the work of the Holy Spirit, indisputably wanting to bring a deeper unity that crosses our humanly created denominational divisions.
I mean, I have to bring you in there, Shamara, as a fellow charismatic. What are your thoughts on the kind of pneumatological approach to ecumenism?
Yeah, so just going to the point about unity over uniformity, not to be uniformed, we want unity. You know, at CT, we talk about having a community of disagreement. And whilst this, of course, appears paradoxical, it is a sacrificial commitment to community, whatever the cost. And I know we said we don't want to be naive in the power of relationship, but particularly in the Pentecostal movement, we believe in koinonia and diakonia, you know, and that commitment to an intense fellowship despite the disagreements. I don't believe as Christians across the kingdom, across the ecumenical landscape, we are called to be uniform or called to be the same. I think that's highly boring, if I'm able to put it in simple terms. That's not the calling. That hasn't been the commission, actually. It's to spread the gospel in any way that we can. So within the Pentecostal community, that pneumatology, that relationship building, we have a great emphasis on koinonia. And I think that's even some of the distinct difference we'd even say between the charismatic movement and the Pentecostal movement. There is that deep, there's class issues there as well, I would say, but that deep commitment to koinonia, to working class communities, to bringing people into unity from different classes around fellowship. We use a lot of food to do that as well. And so, you know, oftentimes churches have tea and biscuits. We might actually have chicken and rice, you know, and really bring people into that fellowship. So that's what I'd say there.
Hmm. Jan, did you want to come in on that?
We can help with that.
Well, I think I'd say two things. One thing is, and I hope this doesn't sound too trite, but I think it also underlies an ecumenical challenge, is that, let's face it, we don't have unity of belief at the grassroots level in our own churches individually. I'll just speak for the Catholic Church. I think, you know, the synodal process has brought that very much to the fore, that if you asked, you know, you used to say, if you asked a Catholic anywhere in the world what they believe the church taught or what was the teachings of Jesus Christ, you get a similar answer. Well, I've been in the room with many Catholics from across the whole world several times in this whole synodal process, and you get some very different answers. So I don't want to say tritely, we've also got to sort our own house out, but we do. And Pope Paul VI said this, you know, at the time of the Second Vatican Council. And, you know, one of our documents on Christian unity of the Second Vatican Council says that we have to put our own house in order, whatever that means. And perhaps that goes back to Paul's thought on, you know, theologically thinking through some of the knottier issues alongside the whole ecumenical process. If I could, the other thing I would say is just to say that actually on that relational thing and going back to the bishops, sorry to keep harping on about this, but actually with the relationship, we all know in our human relationships, in our friendships, there are good moments and there are difficult moments. And sometimes we grow through the painful moments. So, for example, when we've been having these bilateral meetings every 2 years, normally, and up until Liverpool, however it had been arranged, that the Eucharist that was celebrated was always a Catholic Eucharist. And so the Catholic bishops would all be there celebrating Mass, and the Anglican bishops and the others would all be in the congregation, and the Anglican bishops would come up to receive a blessing. Now, 2 years ago in Liverpool, Cardinal Nicholls was presiding, and at the point of distribution of Holy Communion, just started speaking extempore and saying how painful this was, and that he actually realised what a difficult moment this was. Now, whatever happened at that moment, none of the Anglican bishops came forward for a blessing as they would normally do. And it wasn't because they were angry or cross, but I think everyone just absolutely acknowledged that this was a deeply difficult moment, that all these bishops had been together for 24 hours, and yet at the Eucharist, there's this painful moment of separation. So much so, and I'm going to finish in a moment, you know, when we were in Norwich, the decision was taken that we would have an Anglican Eucharist, not a Catholic Eucharist. And so Archbishop Justin Welby presided over a Eucharist in Norwich Cathedral, and the other Anglican bishops sat with the Catholic bishops in the congregation. And at the moment of Holy Communion, the Catholic bishops went for a blessing from the Archbishop of Canterbury. And Justin Welby at that moment gave fairly individual blessings to each person that he blessed. And I think in some way, that was a response to exactly what had happened 2 years ago in Liverpool. So I think sometimes in our relationships, we have to go through pain. And, you know, hopefully that enables our bishops and others of our church leaders across the whole spectrum to really understand the knottier challenges that, you know, we've been bringing to the fore a bit, so that when they are united together and they're talking to other of church leaders across a broader spectrum of countries, then these things can be mentioned, because these, I think, in particularly in synodal structures, are the only ways in which we're going to, I would say, move things along. Now, I realise some people might still say this is quite naive and the churches move quite slowly, but I think these experiences are worthwhile, because like in all our human relationships, I think I look at my own friendships, the moments of greater growth have not been when everything's been going really smooth. It's been in those moments of challenge or crisis or real pain when you value a friendship and you grow because of that. And we all know that. And so I think, you know, there is something within that, notwithstanding we're still on the journey. We're still very much on that journey.
It's really interesting listening to this conversation, because I think I and a lot of other people not involved in ecumenism often have a perception that it's just kind of a bunch of nice people drinking tea and saying nice things, and then it's a talking shop and we go back to our normal lives and nothing changes. But actually it sounds like, you know, for it to work, for it to be good ecumenism, you have to actually lean into the pain and the uncomfortableness and the awkwardness and the visible signs of division and separation, and actually don't kind of take the easy way out of just saying, let's go and have tea next door, but actually sit there in the moment where he's saying, I can't, or I won't, or I'm not allowed to receive the body and blood from you like I would from my other brothers and sisters, and actually kind of stare that division in the face, almost as a way to inspire us not to get complacent about the separation.
Yeah. I think we also can't ignore the influence of Western enlightenment and our constant move towards progress, which sometimes doesn't even give us the space for the concept of suffering, suffering well, as Father Jan said, to hold those uncomfortable conversations about our disagreement, because we must always be going to the point of progress and betterment. You know, so it just skips past sometimes the necessary process in relationship, which is honesty, and to say some things we don't disagree on, and that's okay. But I'm going to commit to walking in pilgrimage with you. And I think sometimes that's the challenge that we have, and we can't ignore some of those ideological forces that are at play and shaping how we think about things.
Hmm. And just lastly then, because we're running out of time, but if someone is listening along and has been, you know, inspired, like, are there ways that ordinary Christians can feed into these processes that can, if you feel passionate about Christian unity in a way you haven't before, like, what are the best ways that people can kind of throw their shoulder to the wheel, as it were?
Well, a couple of very practical things would be for each of us to ask ourselves, what spheres of influence do we have? We all have different spheres of influence. You know, it might be that we serve on the parish council. It might be that we run the finance committee or whatever it is. How might that be enriched by bringing an aspect of ecumenical engagement into it? Not as an additional good thing to do that distracts from the other good things, but how can what we already have to do be enriched and facilitated by bringing some ecumenical engagement into it? That's one thing I would say. Another thing I would say is, for those of us who are in situations where we can't always break the bread of Eucharist together, we can, thank God, break the bread of the Word together. We could meet around the Word, and meet not simply to have a nice prayer time and scripture sharing, but make it intentional about how can we meet each other? How can we meet each other in our differences through the breaking of the Word? I think there are a couple of practical things.
Thank you. Yeah. And a final thought from anyone else before we wrap up? about where we're going with ecumenism, or how people might want to join in.
Ecumenism, particularly from a Churches Together in England perspective, we are speaking to a lot of social justice issues. So if people do want to get involved with that, there's organisations such as Christian Aid, which is an ecumenical institution where you can look at international poverty. There's also local Churches Together in England groups and meetings that you can get involved with. But I think that social justice and social action piece is a great entry point for ecumenical relationships as well.
Brilliant. All right. Well, we'll have to call it quits there. Thanks so much for all of you. It's been a really fascinating conversation. Jan, Paul, Shamar and Christopher, really grateful to have you on the show. And I hope everyone listening along has enjoyed that as much as I have. But I'll be back with another episode soon. So stay tuned. But thank you and bye-bye. That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But before you go, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. And why not tell a friend about the show too? And if you'd like even more church news analysis, you can also subscribe to my new free email newsletter, The Critical Friend. Each week, I send an email packed with links to interesting things happening in the church world and my commentary on them. Just visit tswyatt.substack.com. to find out more and subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.